Network Automation Nerds Podcast. Hello and welcome to Network Automation Nerds Podcast, a podcast about network automation, network engineering, and many technology topics. I'm your host, Eric Cho. In today's episode, we'll continue on our conversation with Damian Garros, CEO and co-founder of Opsmill. Last week, we talked about a little bit about Damian's background and what led him to the founding or the solving of this problem for Opsmill. And I'm super excited to continue our conversation. So welcome back, Damian.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, so where we left out last week was a very interesting topic on both the, on the technical level, as well as on, like the soft skill level, right? One thing you mentioned was we should pay more attention to other, verticals. We're unique, but we're not that unique. We're special, but we're not that special. And I totally agree with that. So, and what spun off that was, of course, the relational versus the graph database and so on. So why don't we continue on that topic, right? First of all, on, your that was your aha moment you were mentioning, that you look at other industries and you say, hey, everybody, retail, e-commerce, or e-commerce, almost the same thing, but e-commerce, healthcare, and all these other industries are coming to this realization that they have to have extensible schema and using graph database. So why don't you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, so that was actually the first one. And then again, I realized that there's a lot of power to bring the data in a central place. Mm-hmm. And then the next logical step is actually when you need to have everything in a central place, that means usually you have to copy the data from somewhere else to be able right. to bring it for consumptions in a central place.
Yeah, you have to extract and load, right? So like the industry was extract, load, and transform. So you're talking about the first two letters.
Yeah, and it's almost another industry, which is about, they call that the data platform, and
yeah.
the people that are specialized in ETL and moving data, and then big use case for it in their case is actually like building dashboards and all that.
Correct.
And
correct.
While looking at an industry, I actually learned about a term that, was like this second aha moment for me was, I saw people talking about data lineage. And what it means is that they realize that basically they are moving the data. And then at the end of the chain, someone is consuming that data. And at some point, this person was not trusting the data. It was like, am I actually looking at the latest data? Has it been updated? The pipeline was so complicated that he was doubting if he was looking at the right one. And so they started having a trust problem. And I think it's the same problem that we also have, and in many way in our case, like in terms of when we start centralizing all the data in a system like NetBox or Nanobot, we have the same problem. I experienced it myself. And so this data lineage, what I realized is that they're not just moving data. As every step of the way, they're also capturing a lot of metadata about the data itself in right. terms of like, where is it coming from? Who is the owner? If there is a problem, who should I go to? And like all of those metadata information, that will basically tell you at the end of the chain if you can trust that data and who you should get to if you have any questions.
Yeah, by the way, I just want to point out that is why the lineage problem is why we're trusting like the production, using that as a source of truth, right? Like it must be right. If it's working in production, that must be like the most optimal way to do it, right? But that's not necessarily true. But for a lack of other, ways to do this, that's why we're always going back to like the switch and say, okay, what's the VLAN structure today?
Yeah. And so when I actually realized that, I immediately in my mind, I was like, okay, we need to be able to capture metadata in addition to the data in the source of truth. Because again, we want to be able to have people bring their data in a central place so that we have a single schema. And this idea of a single source of truth, personally, I'm not sold on it. Like there's always going to be multiple systems. Mm-hmm. So we're always going to have to do some synchronization, but it has to be done right. And what's important is that if you copy a data somewhere, for it to be consumed, you have to protect it and to make sure that no one is going to touch it.
Right.
You have to lock it.
Yeah.
So that's the first place. And the second one is you need to provide visibility of where it is that is coming from to the user so that they understand that if they want to change it, where they have to go. Mm-hmm. And that's where this metadata for me was really you know, super important. So it's actually features that we built into our product. And for me, that was the features. I immediately, again, realized that I would never be able to do that with a relational database, because that means pretty much having a dedicated table for every single attribute.
Right. You have like so many many-to-many relationships. It's crazy.
Yes, that wouldn't work. But in a graph database, it's actually super easy. It's like almost natural. Because the way we organize the data, it's super easy on any given data points to build relationships to create and capture these networks of metadata around each and every attribute. And I guess that was my second, you know, haha moments where I was like, okay, there's no doubt, you know, like we have to move away from relational database and move to graph database and have a system that has a very flexible schema, support metadata, and has version control. And, you know, started building the prototype, and then I started reaching out to Raphael, my co-founder, and he was like, hey, man, I've been facing the exact same problem for years. And then we started to, join forces and decided to start the company together.
Wow, that's very interesting, right? I mean, I think a lot of us in the engineering world, you know, we realize the problem and we may have like a technical solution, but it's one thing to realize and, even have a prototype, but it's another to actually leaving the safety of a corporate world. Even though you were always, you know, just from our conversation, you're always in the startup world, right? So it's inherently more risky than say Juniper or Cisco, but at the same time, it's another really leap of faith to actually go start your own company. So tell us more about that.
Yeah, I think pretty much since I graduated, I knew someday I will, you know, start a company.
Nice.
I always had this entrepreneur mindset, I think from like intrapreneur, they call that, like, you know, in a lot of different places I was...
Sure, or spin-ins, as Cisco would say it, right?
So I was always trying to push, you know, my own project and things like that internally.
Right.
And I think, again, you know, to do it, you need to have the right idea. And so It took me, I've been thinking about that for probably 5 years before I actually decided to jump.
Oh, wow.
I got lucky that thanks to Roblox, I had, you know, a bit of saving that would give me the freedom of like not have to worry every day and give me a little bit of space so that I can, you know, do that.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, there was also, you know, finding the right partners, super important to actually have the right partner. So I was lucky to find find Raphael. So Raphael Monnier is a very experienced entrepreneur in the infrastructure space. He was also based in France. And so we really met, you know, we had the same experience with the problem, same passion for it. So that was also a very big part of creating that company, because it's really hard to do that alone. So
where is Opsmo today? So you mentioned you met him, Raphael, and he's I guess he's he had exits before it, or was he multiple exits,
two of them, yeah. We're you know, very actively building the product. We're making our way through a beta, so more like in a private manner. Right now, working with multiple, like we call that, design partners.
Sure.
Companies that have experience in automation, that understand some of the pain points that we're trying to solve, and they are very eager to work with us to help us, you know, finalize the design. We assemble the team, so the we managed to, we got very lucky. We are in our industry, like, for example, we're so lucky to manage to get Patrick Ogenstad to join us. You know, a lot of you probably know him. He's done a lot of writing in the industry. So early on, we managed to have Patrick, and then we have other member of the team. Right now we're actively building the product.
Nice. So, there's just a lot of interesting ideas, right? And, you know, coming into kind of this problem space, you almost have to go through the same pain point that you have done before, right? To have this kind of convincing yourself that this is like graph database for example, is the way to go versus relational database. And for people who are not, who are using spreadsheets, right? Who are not even using a regular relational database or APIs to solve their problem, it almost like it takes a leap of faith to trust you to say, hey, Damien, you know, I think you've done all of these other stuff. And now you come to that conclusion, just as you were looking at other industry, right? Like other smart people who have faced the same problem come to this conclusion. So I trust you and I will use your product. So is that true, or is that how are you acquiring these, like you said, right? Like these beta users who are experiencing the same problem?
I mean, there's certainly an element of trust. Now, I think it's if the pain point is big enough, people are really eager to find a solution. And in this specific space, we talk to so many companies that are building automation, and every single one of them, they are looking for solution to those problems. How do I manage more extensibility, more version controls, and basically make my entire stack more manageable? Mm-hmm. So when you come and bring a different approach and, you know, potentially a solution to their problem, then they're really, of course, they think about the maturity of the product and the risk, but they, you know, that really helps, I think, make the jump.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, if they didn't have a problem, they would not even talk to us.
Right. So,
and then that's kind of also what I wanted to bring at AutoCon, and why I did this presentation is, I feel like today we're not talking enough about those problems. Like, we see more people that are getting started in automation, that are super excited, that are building their first CI/CD pipelines and deployments, and they write blogs that is like, it feels like, you know, all the problems have been solved. Again, super excited that we get more people and more energy in this space and more voices. I think it's great, but I wish we would also, you know, acknowledge that this is just one generation in our journey. And I think we made such a big leap from where we were previously with the spreadsheet. Now, it's not the end of the journey. You know, there's still a lot of work ahead of us. And I think, you know, we need to keep looking and working, and it's not necessarily mean that, you know, bad for the current generation of the tool. It's just, you know, the evolution. There's always many, many generation of tools. And I really love to have more discussion on that. I think, again, we've been thinking about it. We've been trying to bring all of that into design of what we're doing. But I think as an industry, if everyone was actually brainstorming on that and openly talking about those limitations, you know, that will help us move even faster.
Yeah, so let's change gear a little bit on just, you know, from the product side. So now we know, you know, a little bit about your background, which is certainly extensive and, you know, high level, very technically involved. And now you're building your own tool. But now, you know, that's doing at the macro level as you were, you know, starting to get into, right? So what do you think about, you know, the industry in general, like you said, right? Like, you know, so I have my own personal opinion on, you know, the kind of like the polarization of network automation, where we have people who are living in their own bubble, who everything is hyperscale, everything is Google, Amazon. And we have people who are, you know, in their own team, which is like one or two, like 1.5 network engineers, right? That the 0.5 also handles Windows server administration and all that. What are your thoughts on that? You know, where is the industry right now in terms of network automation?
It's a good there was a lot of discussion about that in Denver,
right?
You know, first, I think it's massively growing. You can tell that, you know, the number of people that are participating in this discussion, just the number of people we had in Denver was actually pretty mind-blowing. We had 350 people.
Mm-hmm. Minus one, this dude right here.
I remember in 2018 there was an for me, which was the previous network automation conference that was organized actually by Network2Code before I joined them.
Right.
It was done on the side of Interop. Not Interop.
Oh, no, I remember that. It was virtual, wasn't it?
No. We actually had one initially in Vegas.
Okay.
And that was amazing. But at the time, we may have like 80 people in the room or something like that.
Yeah.
And I was.
I wanted to say Interop, but maybe that's not it.
I think it was Interop, yeah.
Okay.
And JSON was the driver and the Network2Code team at the time behind that. But yeah, so looking now, having 350 people, you can definitely tell that the community has grown. I think there's more realization that my takeaway from Denver, the first one, in what I really like, is more people now are talking about design-driven automation.
Okay.
I think it's probably a better term than intent-based networking, but this idea that in many cases, you know, we always have a design behind what we're doing. And it's just that today this design is not properly captured. And we need to see more, we need to be that, to have the design as part of the automation tools. Like in the past, I think the automation was focusing on the low-level elements that will generate from the design, but they will not necessarily capture the design.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jeremy Schumann did a really great presentation at Denver explaining how he's doing that at MLB. Personally, I really like the what the Arista guys are doing with the AVD project, where they also have this design aspect in mind. Mm-hmm. And I've had many conversations at AutoCon where people also start to think along those lines. And I know many customers that are thinking the same. It's like, we need to start capturing our design, and we need to have tools and our own system, and that would generate the low-level implementations based on this higher-level design. And that's how we're going to make all of that manageable. And again, so I'm very excited with that, because for me, at the end, it goes back to capture all of that in a proper source of truth. That means you need even more extensibility of the schema, because
absolutely,
while the technical layer is probably going to be shared across everyone, but the design is going to be different. So that just speak to what we're building and align with our vision. So I think that was pretty exciting.
Oh yeah, totally, right? Because I remember, you know, even back at when I was at Microsoft, I mean, this is all open, you know, public information, right? Like, we'll have different versions of our data centers, V9, V8, V10, so on and so forth. And every time we finalize that design, right, going from V9 to V10, for example, there's many, many messy iterations and inputs from different business teams, like, you know, at Microsoft. So you have, you know, from Bing, from Azure, from Office, Windows, whatever. And then those were like kind of mixed together, and then you got this jumbo, you know, output at the end where we have that design, but none of that was captured, right? So, like, you know, maybe this was the decision. It was a compromise between like the requirement from Azure and Windows or whatnot. And then on, you know, Vision 11 design, because those were not captured, we're making the same mistake. We're talking about the same discussion that we've had before. And then, you know, we may or may not come up with the same conclusion just because the people in charge were different. So I totally see what you're talking about on, you know, being more the low technical detail. This is the switch that we, you know, the switch spec that we, you know, settled on. This is the vendor. This is how many ports. This is a spine and core layer. But none of that prior stuff were captured. So if we had been able to capture all of that, that would have saved us a quick iteration time so much.
Yeah, and again, I think the best public version of that is what Arista is doing. So go check it out. You know, Arista Validated Design, they're doing really, really good stuff.
Right, but the problem with that is it's just Arista, right? They're not going to capture it
in a way. But again, at least sometimes people need to see to understand. And so they've done an amazing job actually to put a lot of things outside. They have videos. They're really good at. They have really great documentation. So yeah, this idea of design-driven automation for me is really well represented by the Arista team.
Yeah, and also it matches what you were talking about before, right? Like capture the meta history.
And the other aspect that I took from the conference was, I feel like there's more and more people that realize that we need more professionalization of this space.
Okay.
One thing that was actually missing for me, and maybe I'll add my own perspective to it, is there was always discussion like, hey, you know, we're still talking, hey, there's the network engineers, there's the software engineer. Do we need to have the network engineer learn code, or do we need to have the software engineer learn networking? I perceive what was missing in this conference is the acknowledgement that it's neither of them. It's like, okay, we need to have a new roles. We need to have a network automation person or a network NRE, or like it's not the net, like the network engineer will have to learn some of the stuff, but that doesn't mean they have to become full programmers. And the software engineer is not going to be a network automation architect. You know, for me, it's like there's this new field that we're creating right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people will probably transfer from both sides. Like, we'll see software engineers becoming automation architects, and we'll see network engineers becoming automation architects. But we just have to accept that we're creating a new function in the organization, and it's more than just which one do we need to train to do the other job or so on.
Hey, if you come up with a new term, let me know, right? Because I'm dying to do that as well, right? Like, I was so excited when people came out with DevOps or, you know, like this new way of describing what we're seeing already, right? So, but coming up with a term that accurately captures the ideas and concepts, that is the hard part. But, you know,
for me, that would be network automation architects. And okay. Actually, when I was at Network to Code, I pushed really hard for us to create a team.
Okay.
That was called the architecture team, because even inside Network to Code, we had these situations where we had a lot of really bright people, all very knowledgeable about automation. But at some point, we realized not everyone was able to lead the design of an entire platform with the customers. And then I will personally think this role of network automation architect or infrastructure automation architect is really has some specific skills.
Mm-hmm.
And then
there's
the other
a
role
of the tongues like platform engineering, right?
So platform engineering for me is more like the network reliability engineers. It's like
sure.
The people that make sure the tools are running and understand the business aspect of those tools and the business aspect of what they're actually managing, so that they can make, like, the NRE is the one that has a deep understanding of the network and has software skill. He may not have understanding of the network architecture, but he can write the code to make the network work. So that's the NRE for me.
Yeah, and good point.
In that organization, I think you will have NRE and you have network automation architects and you'll have network engineers and network architects. Like, all roles have a place. But yeah, so I wish there was more of that in the conference. And the last one was more professionalization, in the sense that there was few discussion. I wouldn't say it was a general agreement, but there was few people trying to push the narrative that, you know, we need to have more vendors. And I'm not saying that because we're in
this vendors trend. At the conference or vendors within the space?
Within the space. It's just at some point.
Oh, more competition, you mean? Okay.
It's also like, and I think Jeremy Schumann was the one really pushing for it. He was like, you know, I should not have to build all those tools. Like, if we're in an industry where everyone has to build their own tools and build a software team internally,
yeah,
it's not going to work. And so he was really pushing, like, we need to have vendors that build the right tools so that we can buy them and integrate them. Like, we're too much into the do-it-yourself kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
I you know, of course, I'm biased right now, but in many ways, I'd like to think that I decided to make the jump and do all of that because I had the same belief in the same place, that the only way we actually get out is by having better tools and more mature tools. Like, I personally also wish we had better open source community.
Yeah.
In a sense that, you know, we were talking about Kirk earlier and all the work that it does. And
need more Kirks.
Sorry?
No, I would say we need more Kirks and we need more Jeremy Schumann, but at the same time, they're saying, no, I don't want to do it, right? Like, I should be offloading that to people who actually get paid to do it.
Honestly, if everyone that was using what Kirk is maintaining was giving him, like, even just like $10 a year,
right?
He could probably hire a team of people to work with him. And I wish, you know, we would have ways for companies to bring back more money into the open source tools that they use.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like we're missing that right now. The open source community that we have some great projects, but it's all based on individuals. You know, at Network to Code, we'll call that the hero mindset, or like the hero culture. It's like we really depend on people doing these extra miles to maintain those projects. And I think that long-term, that's not going to be sustainable. Again, huge kudos to anyone that is doing that today and contributing and all of that. And I've tried to do my own share of that. But yeah, as an industry, we really need to start thinking, okay, you know, that's a lot of work that deserves something. So, you know, we should really try to think of how we could bring more money into, like, someone at the conference, you know, brought the idea that, hey, maybe we need to have a foundation. Like,
yeah.
Like the CNCF, but for our kind of project, so that companies, easier for them to put money into it, and then these foundations can, you know, bring back or redistribute some of that money to the open source projects.
Yeah, not just that's what very interesting, right? Because that's what PSF, like the Python Software Foundation, started to do. I don't know if people are familiar with it, but you know, so the problem with Python, of course, was like there are tools, open source tools like Request or, you know, some other libraries that are used by billion-dollar company, Fortune 500, by NASA to you know, to land spacecrafts on Mars and space station, but these would rely on like five dudes in their garage maintaining it, right? So so the Python Software Foundation have decided, and also there are like other, you know, grassroots movement on Python meetups and so on that are depending on one or two people to maintain, you know, like the meetup in Seattle, meetup in LA or whatnot. So the Python Software Foundation have created this non-profit structure. There already are the 503s, and so they do all the paperwork, but now they're grabbing like the Django, the meetups and the Request software, or the Flask, for example, right? That project, they come in so they don't have to deal, and then they allocated funds to them so they don't have to deal with like the paperwork, having the directors or having like quarterly board meetings in order to still qualify for that nonprofit. So that's super interesting that you brought it up.
Yeah, I'm, that was just a all-way conversation. But my hope is, you know, maybe our industry moved toward more of that. I think that would be, you know, we need more. I really believe in open source. Again, I've been involved, you know, we're actively thinking, and most likely, you know, what we're building is going to, you know, be in open source.
Yeah. Oh, really? Oh, wow.
I don't want to commit anything, you know.
No.
But it's definitely, you know, something we're discussing, you know, very often, because I do see a lot of the value of that.
Yeah, at least being entertained on that front, right?
Yeah, but again, this today it's hard because so many people are seeing open source are just like taking it and not giving back.
Right.
So that's also, I think, what's like holding probably a lot of company from, you know, participating. So.
For me, I don't think it's people don't want to give back. It's almost like the remember when prior to what is that music streaming platform?
Spotify.
Yeah, Spotify. So prior to Spotify, right, it was hard to just pay 99 cents or whatever or Apple Apple Music, right? It was very hard for them to enjoy the benefits of digital music without properly licensing it, right? But once you provide people with a way to enjoy the music, you know, legally stream it, legally, you know, purchase the digital rights and so on, then people are willing to do that. So, what are your thoughts on that?
I agree. I think, you know, my analysis will be actually the people that wants to give back are probably not the one holding the wallet.
Mm-hmm.
When the company, the technical community is usually involved with open source and they see the value, but they don't necessarily have the ability to, you know, make the move.
Right.
The second one will be that, you know, I think the open source product today are structured to receive some money.
Yeah.
There was this aspect that, you know, you need to have an organization to receive the money. You need to have an organization to redistribute that to the contributors. Like there's probably a lot of things missing. So, yeah, not the blame is not just on the users. I wasn't trying to pick them as like, you know.
No, we love the users. Please continue to use it and, you know, give us eyeballs.
Yeah, for sure. But I maybe it's more on the managers. You know, there's probably a lot of things. You know, one thing I really love is there's few companies that are actually like actively basically redistributing to the open source for all the project that they are using internally.
Mm-hmm.
I know like Sentry. Sentry have been very open about that. And they have a call, and you know, and I think it's really the right mindset that, hey, we couldn't build a product without it. So we're going to redistribute some of our benefits to the community. I wish more company would do that. I certainly hope and plan on doing that myself, you know, when we get to the point where we actually have revenue. but yeah, maybe some thoughts, you know, but that probably needs to come from higher up in the management chain.
Yeah, I think it just needs to be discussed, right? Like talking about it really is the first step. I mean, I had Danshu on, who's the organizer for PyCon and some of the other like PyData and all that stuff within the Seattle community. And he's now, I think his partner of a VC fund who is sponsoring these open source projects for Python data science. So I think talking about it really is the first step, and we need to figure out or just borrow it from Python, for example, on the right approach and business model so that I can make it work. I mean, something I didn't realize was, a lot of projects are saying, open source projects saying, hey, we could survive on $20,000 a year, right? But for companies like Microsoft, it's easy for them to write a $20,000 check, but it's hard for them to write it to a small company to just write $20,000. They'd much rather just do a one-time thing for $100K for, 2 years, right? And then they have to justify to their company on what are we getting out of it. Maybe it's driving the direction of that project. Maybe sitting on the board or influence the decision or which feature to implement and so on. But does that impact the nature or the spirit of open source or community driven? So I think talking about it is the first way. And the second is really to figure out a business model where that's sustainable.
Yeah. I really hope as an industry, we can have more of this conversation, again, make some progress toward that, whatever is the way it looks like. But
yeah,
we need something like that, I think.
It goes back to what you were talking about before the end of our first part was, we need to look at other industry more, right? We need to get out of our own silo and go look at, okay, what are other people doing? In my own small way, that's what I'm trying to do too with the podcast is just invite people who are in the network industry, but like yourself, who has a very diverse background, and even people like Don. I don't think that episode ranked like the top five that were listened, but it was worth it. It was worth to look at from a business perspective and look at it from like a VC perspective on, why sponsor open source, right? Like, what's in it for me? Is it just out of the goodwill of me? That could be it, but to be on the long-term sustainability, it needs to have something in it for me as well.
Yeah, 100%. I'll go back and listen to this one.
Oh, no. I mean, that's not my own prop. That's not what I meant. But I totally agree to everything you're saying. I'm happy that the conversation's starting. And it was so good to see, like, even just the launch of AutoCon 0 on, such a well-received. And hopefully we'll see AutoCon 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, right?
Yeah, I heard they're already planning on one. So,
they're planning on one.
They already mentioned that. Yeah, they're most likely. I think one is going to be
in Europe.
In Europe, in spring, and then they're planning, two in the US back in fall. So.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully it's not too late in the year. I mean, they had it in Denver. I'm glad it didn't snow or anything, right? But it's a non-zero chance that you might get a bad weather and we'll see.
I didn't even have to leave the hotel anyway, so could have been outside that I probably wouldn't have noticed. So
yeah, exactly. Well, thanks again, Damien, for being on the show. So where can people find you on social or on to find more information about what you're building, what you're up to?
Yeah, the best, nowadays probably LinkedIn and GitHub.
Okay.
Still, from time to time on Twitter or X, but, more as a learning than really writing.
Okay. Awesome. Well, thanks again for being on the show. I really enjoyed our conversation. I hope, to see, I will invite you back once the product is launched. How far away do you think, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but how far away do you think that you have some sort of like version 0.1 beta out in public?
Yeah, the public aspects were still, I'll say, 3 to 6 months, but again, don't hold me to that, please.
Oh, wow. That's really quick. I mean, I guess, you do have investors that needs to be taken care of, right? That you need.
We're working on that too, but yeah.
Oh, okay. Got it. Cool. Well, thanks again for being on the show. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Network Automation Nerds podcast today. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and all the other podcast platforms. Until next time. Bye-bye.